You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Americans are big fans of convenience, and personal banking has been one of the latest things to get revolutionized. We'll talk to a banking expert about the end of paper checks, what exactly a digital wallet is, and more.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. An audit finds that the state's contract with Foxconn could put taxpayers on the hook for jobs based outside of Wisconsin. We're getting a better idea of what cooperation between Governor-elect Tony Evers and Republican leaders could look like. And the chancellor at UW-Whitewater has resigned after her husband was accused of sexual harassment on campus.
Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, the latest on Foxconn now, Rob. The state's legislative audit committee has been analyzing Wisconsin's contract, and they say there's maybe a red flag on which workers could lead to payments from the state to Foxconn. What are we seeing here?
Right. So, yeah, one of the outcomes from this audit is the company could claim credit for workers who are directed from and paid from Wisconsin, but who might not be working in Wisconsin. So that is, it's a little bit distinct from the issue of, like, we know there's a big giant employer that's sort of close to a state line, and it's probably normal to think that some workers may be driving across the state border from Illinois or whatever. That's one thing. This would be like a remote worker, so somebody who's doing IT support or human resources or whatever, could be in Florida potentially or wherever, and Foxconn would be able to claim credit for those workers for the purpose of their tax credit.
So as I understand it, that worker would be paying state income tax because they're getting paid from a Wisconsin company, I think, but the idea is, they're not paying rent or a mortgage in Wisconsin, not buying stuff at Wisconsin stores, going to Wisconsin restaurants. The benefit of that worker isn't what the taxpayer might hope it would be.
Right, exactly so. And, it's like a lot of things when it comes to Foxconn, like those who are inclined to, be more bullish on the deal, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald or the CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, they're saying maybe this is something that we should look at. It's not that big of a deal. They're still paying Wisconsin state income tax, and it's going to be a small number of workers. But, like, this is at least could be perceived as a loophole that exists. And if for those who are not inclined to give Foxconn the benefit of the doubt, it's a concern.
Is there talk about tweaking the rules here to make this less likely?
There is, absolutely. And yeah, there were those statements of support from Fitzgerald and from Wiedek, but none of these credits are tied to job creation. None have gone into effect. None will be paid until, unless and until there are actual workers. So, yes, there is an expectation that there will be some response to as a result of the audit.
Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald also talked yesterday about what the next session of the legislature will look like. We've got divided government, governor-elect Democrat Tony Evers, Republicans still controlling the legislature. One of the issues Evers campaigned on was the idea of taking this federal Medicaid money for Wisconsin. Republicans haven't wanted to do that. What did Fitzgerald have to say about it?
Yeah, Fitzgerald was not exactly supportive. I don't think even really all that open to it, but it did represent a slight opening in the rhetoric. He said that he didn't really see it. There are a lot of moving parts to the budget, and the quote was, "I don't want to be presumptuous and rule it out."
So, yeah, not ruling it out completely is at least a slight change from what Republicans have said over the last 8 years or so.
Right, and this is such, Medicaid expansion is kind of a weird issue in Wisconsin. So under Governor Scott Walker, Republicans actually did expand the state's Medicaid program in the same way, basically, that the Affordable Care Act did. They just have refused to take the federal funding that the Obamacare law made available. So I find it weird. This fight is not to do with any particular principle. The state takes federal funds for roads and all kinds of other things. But in this case, because I think some Republicans feel it's important to not to sort of accept Obamacare as a legitimate law, they've chosen to forego the federal funds. Now, going into a state budget year, this you could imagine that this amounts to about $280 million that would be available. It'd probably be pretty useful in a state budget process. So that's why this is sort of on the table or an active discussion, I guess.
Talking to Rob Metzer from the USA Today Network Wisconsin about the top stories in Wisconsin news. And you mentioned that state budget process. It sounds like, so we're going to have a budget proposed by Governor-elect Evers early next year. What are state lawmakers saying they're going to do when it comes to the budget?
Yeah, so the Republicans are going to start off with the state's current budget levels and sort of take the current spending levels and build a new budget out of that. They say that they will be involved in negotiations with the new governor, but what they won't do is take the governor's budget, which will come out sometime in January, as their starting point for negotiation. And I guess it's pretty obvious that the legislature and the governor are going to have some different priorities next year. But that's what they've said. They're intentionally trying to kind of cut the legs out from underneath the governor's budget look, that's a non-starter. We're going to do our own thing.
And here's a bit of what Fitzgerald had to say about the budget process.
Now, that doesn't mean that there couldn't be some common areas where, again, I talked to the governor-elect this morning about this, where there would be some common interest, where maybe we could get some veto assurances that he would just, keep his pen off of that area and build some consensus.
Well, sounds like they'll work together just fine. No problems next year,
Rob. No problem. Yeah, no, I guess we'll talk to you when the budget's signed.
All right. Yeah, it could be a rocky road. We'll see. I want to turn to another story, Rob. This story's been on for a bit. UW-Whitewater Chancellor Beverly Copper announced this week that she's resigning. Over the summer, her husband was accused by multiple people of sexual harassment on campus. Talk about what all happened there.
Right. Copper's husband, Pete Hill, was actually banned from campus as a result of these complaints. Now, the complaints were to do with her husband and his behavior, sexual harassment against women on campus, university employees. But there were some related allegations that she, Copper, had created a hostile work environment, that there wasn't a way for people to, make complaints about his bad behavior, I guess. So she announced that she'll resign from that position as of the end of the year. However, she will stay with the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. She's going to be on administrative leave for through August, and then she'll join the faculty as a part of the psychology department.
And I understand she's going to be drawing her chancellor's salary while on leave. It's gotten criticism from state lawmaker, Republican Senator Steve Noss, a frequent critic of the UW system in general. What's happening there?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think that this would be a simpler case if the allegations were against her, but they're not against her. They were against her husband. But it is nevertheless the case that within the university system, she will be able to draw that salary during that period of 8-9 months of administrative leave. And yeah, for a UW critic, that is a good occasion to do some UW criticism.
Wisconsin in some entertainment news. Rob, Chris Cruzy, a musician from Barron, made it deep into the season on the singing competition The Voice on TV. Where did he end up?
Yeah, so you got to hand it to Cruzy. He's got a fine beard. Some people like his sort of rootsy country rock sound, and he finished second place on The Voice, which is quite a run on that show. Yeah.
And then you made your debut on our WASA studio yesterday. Is that right? Any Hodag sightings, Rob?
Yeah, we had some good HODAG information shared in the Route 51 show and a good conversation. I didn't, you know, personally see a HODAG, but I understand we had a caller who was with one, but the line was bad. We weren't able to get that caller on the air, unfortunately.
Maybe next time. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Rob Metzger is a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us for a weekly look at the top news stories from around the state.
No longer do you have to get cash to pay someone back for covering dinner or buying your concert ticket. You also don't have to go to the bank to cash a check. In fact, you don't ever have to go to the bank if you don't want to.
Many Americans are choosing to do their banking online or switching to an exclusively digital bank. Along with that are tons of mobile apps that offer budgeting help, money transfer options, debit cards, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you switched to digital banking, or do you find yourself doing most of your banking online? Do you have questions about all the different stuff that's out there on the market? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
Kimberly Palmer is the banking expert at the personal finance company NerdWallet. She's also the author of several books about money, including her latest called Smart Mom, Rich Mom. Kimberly, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Kimberly, banking is yet another industry that has been impacted by the internet and smartphones. Do we see some of the larger traditional brick-and-mortar banks struggling to keep up with technology?
Well, we do. Basically, there's a huge push towards people being more comfortable with using online banks and going online exclusively for everything they need for banking. And so the traditional banks are really doing what they can to stay competitive. And that often means doing things like offering other services in their bricks and mortar locations. So people that like to be in person for their banking and that high touch banking, people will be drawn to those bricks and mortar banks for those reasons. But for younger people who tend to be more comfortable with online banking, it is hard for traditional banks because, in general, with traditional banks, they tend to offer lower yields on their savings accounts. In some cases, they have higher fees. And so that's where online banks are coming out ahead.
You know, you mentioned traditional banks are now having online banking options, but digital banks are strictly online. How does that work? How do digital banks work, and how do we know we can trust them?
Well, that is a big question, and a lot of consumers still don't feel comfortable moving exclusively online for their banking. Basically, it means you have to have a comfort level with accessing and reviewing your money, tracking your money only through websites and apps. And, you know, online banks have really high levels of security. They have easy-to-use apps. And so it's really about getting consumers more comfortable with using banks. Of course, for some needs, you still need cash. And so that's why a lot of online banks team up with ATM networks. So you can still access your cash for free without paying a fee. So it's not that you're saying you're never going to touch cash again, but the fact is a lot of people have lower need for cash these days, and you can do most of your bill payments, transferring money. You can do so much of that from your phone or your computer.
Now, many people still do value the experience of going to the bank despite the rise in online banking because it's the whole process. It's talking to a teller that they know, talking to other people that are in the bank. It gives them a sense of trust. Do you see trust as a big factor in deciding on a bank?
Absolutely. And that is really the biggest hurdle that online banks have to overcome. They have to basically get people to trust them and feel that their money is safe at those online banks. And of course, in terms of FDIC insurance and making sure your money is insured, you always want to make sure that the online bank is offering that same level of security that a traditional bank is offering. Of course, you don't just want to put your money anywhere. So those are important questions for people to ask. But yes, overall, people are increasing their level of comfort, partly because online banks have been doing so much to assure people, to reassure them that their money is safe.
Kimberly Palmer is a banking expert at a personal finance company called NerdWallet. She's also the author of several books about money, including her latest called Smart Mom, Rich Mom. And we're talking about how personal banking is changing. Aside from offering that in-person experience, are there some other abilities that digital banks still lack that a brick-and-mortar bank still offers?
You know, the only real difference or benefit, the only reason people are still going to traditional banks and resisting online banks is just that comfort level that comes from being able to go in person. I mean, there is something reassuring about being able to walk into a real bank, ask a real person any questions that you have, and plenty of people are still drawn to that. And so that's certainly not going away altogether. But at the same time, the online banks are eating up more and more of the market share of banking in general just because people are feeling more comfortable. But of course, you know, if you want to get a certified check and you need to go get that in person, you probably want to go in person to a bank. There's some things you still can't do online.
How do fees and special offers or even interest rates differ from a digital bank versus brick and mortar?
You know, that's actually a really big difference between online banks and traditional banks because, in general, we find that the highest yields, so the highest interest rates you'll receive on your savings, can be found at online banks. With online banks, we see yields as high as 2.25%. Of course, they're expected to go up and continue rising into the new year. With traditional banks, you're lucky if you're earning 0.1% on your savings. And so that's a huge difference and really a reason why people are going to online banks. They want their money to earn more while it sits there. And then the second factor that you mentioned with the fees, we really see in a lot of cases lower fees with online banks. So, for example, many traditional banks, they have a minimum requirement of how much money you keep in your bank account in order to waive out of monthly maintenance fees. Online banks often don't have that. And so, in general, you see more fees popping up with the traditional banks.
As you know, imitation is the finest form of flattery. So you see many industries that will do something innovative, and then you will find the traditional ones will try to play catch up. Do you see the brick and mortar banks start to do some of the things that online banking are doing?
Yes, we absolutely see that. I think the best example of that is with peer-to-peer payments. So we saw a huge push with apps like Venmo, PayPal, where you can easily send money to a friend with a click on your app on your phone. And so that was something we saw really blow up. And then, of course, banks started offering that, too, through something called Zelle. So traditional banks got in on that. They didn't want to be left out of that trend of, I mean, people want to send money to their friends with their phones. And so we saw banks jump on that. We also have seen a lot of development of better websites, better banking apps. So at traditional banks, you'll find those same online features, the same app features that you'll find at many of the online banks.
You mentioned PayPal and Venmo, those names we hear a lot in terms of people sending money to one another. Can they be your bank, or are they more supplemental?
Yeah, they're definitely supplemental. You wouldn't want to be exclusively using those apps because they are really all about sending money to friends and family. And in fact, those apps, like the ones you mentioned, Venmo, PayPal, they specifically emphasize you don't want to use these apps to send money to strangers. So if you are, for example, buying something online and you need to transfer money to someone you don't know, you don't want to do that through those apps because they lack the protection that a lot of the traditional banks offer when you're writing a check or sending money digitally. And so people do have to be careful with those peer-to-peer apps. We hear a lot from people who accidentally send money to someone because they use the wrong phone number or the wrong email, and it can be really hard to get your money back in that situation. So you do have to be careful of that.
Can you talk a little bit about the concept of a digital wallet?
Yeah, a digital wallet is basically, it basically just refers to the fact that instead of pulling out your actual physical wallet, getting a check or cash, you have all of your money online on your phone. So if you go to a coffee shop, you might not even pull out your wallet. You could just swipe your phone at the cash register. And so it really refers to that explosion of all of the digital options we have now for making payments.
Who's using that? Is it mostly young people?
You know, young people do tend to feel more comfortable with digital payments in general. And so if you do look at a breakdown by generation, you do see the highest use among millennials, and then it goes up, or the usage goes down as you look at the older generations. But, you know, at the same time, if you look at baby boomers and Gen X, you see a higher usage over time. So in general, people of all ages are becoming more comfortable with this concept of digital payments.
We have just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to mention that we had a caller that was holding that asked, what happens with senior citizens who are less computer literate and can't use online banking?
Oh, it's such a good question, because it's a huge concern. And the good news is that traditional banks are very aware of this issue, and they are working to make sure they can cater to the consumers that don't want to be online. And so you still have options going into the traditional bank. You know, you don't have to get on this digital wallet bandwagon if you don't want to. That might be different in, you know, 10, 20 years, but for now, consumers still have options, and they can choose what they feel most comfortable with. So no one is being forced to go online only.
And finally, are there any changes that you're expecting to see next year when it comes to banking?
Well, basically, we just expect this trend to continue of more people getting comfortable with online banking. Because we're in an environment right now where interest rates are rising, more and more people are taking advantage of that by moving their savings accounts to online banks that pay those higher yields. And so that's the way consumers can really benefit from this.
It's really fascinating stuff, Kimberly. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Kimberly Palmer is the banking expert at the personal finance company called NerdWallet. She's also the author of several books about money, including her latest called Smart Mom, Rich Mom. She joined us to talk about how personal banking is changing.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up Monday morning on Ideas Network, join us for a Tinsel Tales holiday special from 6 to 8 a.m. Voices from NPR's past and present share stories of the season. Some are funny, some are touching, some are insightful or surprising. That's Monday morning from 6 to 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, students entering college typically explore a lot of different courses, including history, math, art, English. But as the job market demands more technology workers and students seek out what many call more practical degrees, some schools are cutting back on liberal arts courses and majors.
Our next guest recently wrote about how colleges are handling liberal arts and looked to the University of Wisconsin to see what the future might hold for humanities education in the future.
Adam Harris is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers education. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you're looking at us in Wisconsin from the national stage. What caught your eye about the UW system?
So when I was transitioning into the Atlantic, I had been hearing rumors that the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point would be announcing a proposal to eliminate a couple of its majors, and it was looking at getting rid of some of its majors to account for a budget crunch. And so shortly after I joined the Atlantic, I saw that there was a proposal to eliminate 13 majors, primarily in the liberal arts and the humanities. And as the months went on, that sort of got whittled down to where it would be a proposal to eliminate six majors, including history. And it, of course, generated a lot of national attention, but it also raised an interesting question when it's not a question of whether or not a liberal arts program is going to be cut, but which liberal arts programs are going to be cut. So we kind of wanted to dig into that a little bit more and see if there was anything instructive to learn about the situation in Wisconsin and anything that could be applied on a grander scale.
And it was presented as, fewer people are enrolling in programs like history and some of these other humanities and social science type programs, and there's more demand for something with a specific job that comes out of it, right?
Yeah, one of the main criticisms of the liberal arts is that there aren't many specific job tethers to those positions, even though students who graduate with liberal arts degrees tend to find jobs and the income and earnings tend to equate with students who were not liberal arts majors. But one of the things that Greg Summers, the provost at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, was essentially telling me was that, you know, students are kind of making these calculations, and they're they're looking to align their study with a career. And jobs are also looking to have, you know, people who have actionable skills in STEM fields. But they also do want some liberal arts background.
Right. It's easy to say, okay, if I go and get a degree in nursing, I know what kind of job I'm looking for. If I get a degree in engineering, I know what kind of job I'm looking for. If I get a degree in history, I know I'm probably not going to be a historian. But is there an argument that still that kind of degree translates into a job future?
Yes, because essentially the argument is that a history degree or a liberal arts degree broadly gives you those kind of critical thinking skills. That's what the argument is. You get a liberal arts degree because you have those critical thinking skills that some people have kind of called soft skills in terms of, you know, your writing, your reading, your communication, the way that you think critically about issues. And so it kind of gives you that fundamental basis I guess humanity, right? As opposed to, you know, you've been taught how to do business marketing, and that's all you know how to do. You should have a more well-rounded student is kind of the argument for the liberal arts.
And then we've got this Wisconsin idea that was a big part of the development of the University of Wisconsin and is kind of part of the mission statement for the system. Can you talk about what that is and how it fits into education around the country?
So yeah, the Wisconsin idea is often attributed to Charles Van Heusen. It's this idea that the boundaries of the university should be the boundaries of the state, right? And he said, "I shall never be content until the beneficent influence of the university reaches every family of the state." And it kind of became that idea. Of course, has transitioned into other states, but it's kind of the basis for a state university system, that it shouldn't just be knowledge that you're building for the institution, but it should be knowledge that can be applied and used in different ways throughout the state. Whether that is so originally the Wisconsin idea, you had professors helping legislators write laws, and it was kind of in this progressive idea. And in 2015, if you will remember, that almost changed, where the Wisconsin idea was kind of proposed to be tweaked from a search for truth and in favor of turning it into a kind of meeting the state's workforce needs. And that's kind of broadly what this fight is about, right? As people are trying to tweak and transition the liberal arts into fitting what is best for state workforce needs, or what we might think is best for job preparation in the future.
Adam Harris is with us, writer at The Atlantic, where he covers education. He's talking about the future of liberal arts in higher education and a debate between the role of universities and colleges, well-rounded liberal arts education, or job and career preparation. Adam, we're not alone in Wisconsin in this debate, right?
No. And kind of across the country, I mean, specifically in history, as you mentioned, since the Great Recession, you've seen a decline in the number of history majors. And particularly one of the reasons why Stevens Point is having to contemplate making these cuts is because they're in a budget crunch, and state funding for higher education has been drying up across the country. I mean, you look at Arizona, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Alabama, you know, these are some of the top states that have seen massive pre-recession level funding cuts over time. Wisconsin kind of falls in the middle of that, but since the Great Recession, they're spending about 23% less dollars per student than they were prior to the recession. So that's kind of affecting this shifting in strategy for colleges to think about, okay, where can we best allocate our dollars? And as Greg Summers said, you know, even for the most noble goals, we can't be everything to everyone. So it's kind of putting colleges and administrators in this kind of very precarious position.
Yeah, and staying at UW-Stevens Point, you heard from administrators there, we're not going to have, say, a history major. That doesn't mean we won't have history courses. And there's an idea that, okay, maybe there's a happy middle ground where, yes, we can have these specific job training skills or STEM programs or whatever, but they still have a humanities and social science and liberal arts element in them, so that, you know, even those people coming out with those more job-specific degrees still have some of that well-rounded education.
Yeah, they're essentially trying to make a model where it's a more focused on the general education curriculum and making sure that students are getting that broad liberal arts background in that general education curriculum. But the argument that's essentially saying we should have the major is that when you have a major, you tend to have more faculty in that major who are able to teach more of the upper level courses and kind of do some of that upper level research where you're thinking at Stephen's point specifically, they have, you know, the courses on the Holocaust, or they have the emphasis on race and ethnicity within the major. So those sorts of things may end up going away, whereas instead you may just have kind of a baseline, you know, this is your U.S. History 1, this is your U.S. History 2, this is your English 1, this is your English 2, this is your composition. And then that's kind of the full extent of what you end up getting. So the argument is that more students are able to get a more depth in the liberal arts if there is a liberal arts major, as opposed to kind of as a part of the general education curriculum.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page what they think of all this. We heard from Gerald, who says, I have a liberal arts degree from UW Parkside. I've done nothing with it. While writing and reading are still a passion of mine, in an ideal world, I'd do something that incorporates those things. Gerald says, I regret the time, effort, and money I've spent on pursuing it. Wish I'd gone for something more useful and practical for a future career. So, at least in this one case, some buyer's remorse on the liberal arts degree. Gerald's probably not alone.
Yeah, and there are kind of, I mean, as the cost of higher education is rising, you know, people are having to make a kind of value proposition, ask and say, what may be the most practical thing in the future? But there are also people who have, you know, gone and got a degree in finance per se and have said, man, maybe I should have done something that was a little bit more challenging in terms of, you know, pursuing a liberal arts degree. Because of those kind of broad-based skill sets that you get as a baseline. I imagine kind of in conversations that I had with some students, they were like, you know, it would be I would feel bad if ultimately I wasn't able to get that broad history degree because, you know, kind of going forward into the future, I can kind of do anything that I want, but to have that and like critically think and kind of exist in this life of the mind while I'm in college is a interesting experience.
We're talking to Adam Harris right now about whether liberal arts majors and courses can survive at colleges and universities in this century. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers education.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about liberal arts education? Do you think colleges and universities should tailor their course offerings to the needs of the job market? Or do you think arts and social sciences are beneficial for students? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
We continue our conversation about the future of liberal arts education in a market that's putting increasing pressure on colleges to produce students with specific job skills. Our guest is Adam Harris. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he covers education.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about all this? Do you think that the liberal arts should be strong and well-funded at colleges and universities in Wisconsin and elsewhere? Or do you think that there should be more focus on degrees, majors that prepare people for particular careers? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard Adam from Gerald earlier, who regretted his liberal arts degree. We also heard on Facebook from Eric, who writes, I'm in information technology in Silicon Valley with my liberal arts degree. He goes on, the humanities, history, and so much more have made me a very complete person, I feel. And this kind of gets to the heart of a lot of debates in education, not just in colleges, but at all levels. Are we training people to do things in the world, or are we trying to develop well-rounded citizens, people who confront the issues of the day in a thoughtful way? This is at all levels, right?
Yeah, this is definitely, and it also gets to the root of something that even the founders were thinking about, right? Where they were even thinking about creating a national university, where George Washington and James Madison, they had this idea of a national university where people would learn not only the you know the sciences and the math and the history, but they would also learn how to be a citizen. So it's there's this question of whether or not colleges, universities are places where we are supposed to be creating citizens and fully formed people, or if it's a place that, as Lee Willis, the chair of the history department at Stevens Point, says, is a place that has to kind of line up behind job preparation.
Let's go to our callers now. Stephen is with us in Kenosha. Stephen, hello.
Hi. I just graduated from Carthage College in Kenosha like a week ago with a political science major. And so I just started looking for jobs. And not surprisingly for me, it's pretty clear there's not a lot of entry-level jobs out there, especially in this area, that directly pertain to political science. But I really value my major and what I learned and the skills that I gained as far as communication and writing skills and the things that I learned that I really don't think I would have learned otherwise in that sort of environment. And I really appreciate what I learned from my professors and that sort of life of the mind that I think was mentioned earlier. I do plan to go to law school at some point, so I think that more directly kind of ties into my major later on. But I understand why they're looking into making those curriculum changes, and we've had these discussions actually in my college courses about sort of the value of a liberal arts education. So I understand these hard decisions need to be made, but I think I agree that keeping those majors on so that those higher-level courses can be taken, I think that's should be done if they can. They should keep them if they can.
Stephen, thanks a lot for the call. Congratulations on graduation. Good luck in the job/law school hunt. A lot there, Adam. Sounds like a little bit of mixed feelings, but generally positive about his liberal arts degree there.
Yeah, and also congrats. But I, you know, in speaking with Greg Summers at Stevens Point, one of the things I wanted to ask him was, you know, if the state were to, you know, reinvest money in higher education. So a lot of this, as I mentioned, is due to cuts to higher ed. But if the state were to reinvest money in higher ed, I asked them, you know, what would you guys do? Would you keep the history major or what? And he had an interesting response where he said, if we suddenly received more dollars, we'd have to ask some pretty hard questions about where we'd want to invest those dollars. And he would point to the enrollment figures to kind of help him make those decisions. So I think as a kind of broader implications piece of all of this is that, you know, colleges, for all intents and purposes, are trying to survive not only for the next couple of years, but into the next decades. And they're trying to kind of preemptively think about what the next iteration of college looks like. And for some, that may not be as many liberal arts majors as it currently is.
Thanks for that call, Stephen. We're talking to Adam Harris from The Atlantic, talking about liberal arts education in Wisconsin and around the country. Elliot is with us next in Delavan. Elliot, hi. Elliot, are you there?
Oh, yes.
Hi, yeah. What did you want to tell us about, Elliot?
Yes, I graduated with liberal arts at UW-Whitewater, and I thought it was the best thing in the world. I had an emphasis in business management, and that's one of the things that's really nice about liberal arts. You can have an emphasis in whatever you want to go into, and then from there you can go into a master's if you want. So it's something to think about for people down the road.
Elliot, thanks. A business degree, but a liberal arts background. You don't have to do one or the other, I guess, Adam.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of as we've been chatting about, it's there's this question of whether or not the liberal arts is kind of giving you this baseline. And, you know, as someone who also has a liberal arts degree, I did a bunch of different things. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. Of course, I ultimately ended up in journalism, so it's kind of using the degree. But I, you know, have several friends. I've spoken to several people, and Stephen being one of them, thinking, you know, I am happy that I have this liberal arts degree because it's kind of given me this basis, right? And I can do other things with it. And I think there is something important, and there's something that can be said for that.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Elliot. John joins us now in Madison. John, hi, what do you think?
I think ultimately what the debate is about the tension that exists between education and the goals of education and the goals of studying history and living in a capitalist society. It's a debate that, you guys are talking about the value of a liberal arts education, but the deeper debate is about what do we as a, what kind of world do we want to live in as a society? You know, we want to make history relevant. We want to make the liberal arts relevant. And I think in a lot of ways, there's a lot of resistance against making them relevant because it involves questioning what it means to live in a capitalist society and maybe changing the power dynamics of the society we live in. And there's a real tension there, and that's one of the reasons conservatives in this country want to defund education. That's just one of the many reasons they do. But thank you,
John. Thanks for the call. Adam, what do you think?
So yeah, there is kind of this tension there between, you know, should higher education be about developing workers? Should it just simply be a, we are getting you ready for job preparation, and we're trying to set you up to make as much money as possible, or is it to develop the whole person? And I think that is an inherent tension between kind of some of the more liberal arts, where it's giving you a baseline, as we've mentioned, and kind of a system of job preparation.
Thanks a lot for that call. Tim is with us now in La Crosse. Tim, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a liberal arts graduate from a private college, Lawrence University here in Wisconsin, an art history major of all things. And, you know, one of the things I noticed when I graduated over 25 years ago that some of my friends from who had received non-liberal arts degrees, indeed did make more money out of college, right out of college. But in the long term, about 10, 15, 20, 25 years out, it seemed like the liberal arts majors were earning more money. So from an economic standpoint, it seems that the liberal arts education pays off not on day one or year one after graduation, but over some time. And that's certainly been true for many of my classmates. And I'm wondering if you're guest has any comments about that, the economics of long-term economics of liberal arts education.
Adam, do we know anything? Do you have numbers handy on that?
I don't have numbers exactly handy, but there was a Wall Street Journal article that I remember looking at as I was working through this, and I just pulled it back up. The headline was, "Good news, liberal arts majors, your peers probably won't out-earn you forever." And so it does. The gap narrows and tends to disappear as things go on, as time goes on. So you really do have to look at, you can't just look at immediate career earnings. You probably can't even look at, you know, 5-year career earnings, because, you know, a liberal arts major may also go to law school or, you know, do those sorts of things, may go to medical school, may go and get their MBA. So I think kind of over the long term, kind of looking at data longitudinally, so 10 years, 20 years on, I think that's when you really start to see what the value of that baseline really was.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Adam, do you see the pendulum going over time toward this more business job training approach than the liberal arts approach now and into the future?
If the response to the story was any indication, the liberal arts isn't going anywhere without a fight. However, there is a strong incentive, particularly if states continue to on the path that they're on, where public higher education is kind of being defunded, then it will be really difficult for schools that are having to make that choice. Now, of course, this isn't going to affect the big universities with large endowments. So it's probably not going to affect the UW-Madisons and the University of Texas Austins and things like that of the world. But some of those smaller regional campuses are going to be forced to make some really difficult decisions in the coming years about, you know, whether or not liberal arts majors as they currently are sustainable.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Adam Harris, staff writer at The Atlantic, talking about the future of liberal arts education.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll find out how a Wisconsin project is using bandanas to help start conversations about mental health and suicide prevention.
That and more, all coming up Monday here on Central Time.